So thank you very much, Terry, for the kind introduction and also for inviting me to this very interesting symposium. So what I want to tell you about today, briefly in the time that I have, is that there are such things as obesogens, although I'm not going to show you a lot of data about that. I'm not going to show you data on this point that obesogen action can reprogram the fate of stem cells in your body, but it can. I am going to show you data about the effects of obesogen exposure and how they're heritable. And they're not heritable in the manner that you learned in your genetics class. We don't cause mutations in the genome, but what we do is we change the epigenome, the control system that regulates whether genes are expressed or not. I'm going to show you some very recent data that was just published about obesogen exposure modifying our response to diet and fasting, which I think is very important for the human situation. And I think what I want to conclude with is that this prenatal exposure to the chemical that we work on, to which we're all exposed, causes heritable changes in the epigenome that make individuals that were exposed more susceptible to becoming obese. So you all know that there is a worldwide obesity epidemic, and I just had to change this slide because it jumped in the US to almost 40% in the most recent statistics from the CDC. And surprisingly to my eyes, it's women are more obese than men, and I wouldn't have guessed that traveling around. And the problem falls disproportionately on minority groups. So it's close to 50% in African Americans and Hispanics, and the Asian population viewed as a whole is relatively low. Unfortunately, African American and Hispanic women, the number is up over 50%. And that's hard to argue that that's a good thing. One of the reasons we care about obesity is because it costs a tremendous amount in the healthcare system and to the quality of our lives. The most recent number is around about $200 billion total extra dollars added by obesity to the cost of healthcare. And that comes from increases in things related to type 2 diabetes, metabolic syndrome, cardiovascular disease, hypertension, stroke, cancer, days off from work. There are many, many factors that all are exacerbated by obesity. So how does obesity occur? There's a lot of doctors in the room, I'm sure, and I hear all the time that it's all about energy balance. And if you go to the website of the National Institute of Digestive, Diabetic, and Kidney Diseases, it says it's all about energy imbalance. And I call that the couch potato syndrome. Here's a cartoon by Eric DeCetis that I love. Any history of diet or exercise in your family? And it's obvious that diet has something to do with obesity. But it's equally obvious that since the rates are continuing to increase, despite unprecedented awareness of the problem, that maybe there's something else going on. This paper came from David Allison's group about 7 years ago. And David Allison is an old-time epidemiologist who works on obesity and things like that. And they decided he didn't ever tell me why he did this, but they decided to look at obesity in animal populations. And they could show that in eight different species of animals, that obesity had increased over the past few decades. So it makes sense that we're making our cats and dogs fat, right? Because we feed them too much, we pamper them too much. But how about feral rats living in cities? They're getting obese too. We're not doing anything for them. And the most crucial result is that four species of research animals, rats, mice, and two species of primates, where we control exactly what they eat and how much they eat, they're obese too. So something about living near humans is contributing to the obesity epidemic also in animals. There was another paper that came out just 2 years ago where this group reanalyzed NHANES data. You've heard about NHANES. And the conclusion was that if you look at the period of 1971 to 2008 and you look at body mass index and how much people are eating and how much they're exercising and the type of food that they're eating, what they could show that was that when at the same amount of caloric intake and the same amount of exercise, that body mass index was 2.3 kilograms, so 2.3 points higher in 2006 than it was in 1988. And that says two things. That says, well, one thing that they showed I didn't say is that physical activity is increasing, not decreasing. And sometimes they show a slide that demonstrates the number of health clubs has doubled in step with the doubling in obesity. And sometimes make the silly argument that health clubs are causing obesity, right? But obviously people are responding. We're trying not to become obese. And the second is that energy balance model, calories in, calories out, all by itself, is inadequate to explain the rise in BMI. Something else is superimposed on that. We know there are other factors. We know that stress and disrupted circadian rhythms and certain kinds of viruses like adeno-associated virus 36, the kinds of bacteria that live in your intestines, changes in a few genes, all of these have something to do with obesity. We know from a lot of epidemiological studies done at the University of Southampton and elsewhere that nutrition, prenatal nutrition, has something to do with obesity. One of the classic examples is the so-called Dutch hunger winter studies, where the Nazis starved basically the population of Amsterdam. Did I turn this off? No, okay. And babies who were conceived during that time and who weren't spontaneously aborted grew up to become obese adults. So this prenatal experience has a lifetime effect on health. And we know that mom smoking causes decreased birth weight and increased risk of obesity later in life. And there was a paper that was kind of a silly paper, but Paula Bailey Hamilton first proposed that chemicals had something to do with obesity. But that topic was picked up by a guy that many of us in this room know, Jerry Heindel at NIEHS. And Jerry had the idea that maybe it wasn't just chemicals per se, but maybe it was a subset of chemicals. Maybe it was endocrine disrupting chemicals that had something to do with obesity. And it turns out that there are a subset of chemicals that have an effect on the endocrine system. I'm sure you know that weight and appetite and things in your body are under the control of hormones, and one of the key players is leptin, the satiety hormone, which we'll hear about later. The thyroid hormone is an important one, and that's the receptor for thyroid hormone is a member of the family of hormone receptors that I trained on, that I work on, and is my favorite system. We also know that the development of fat cells themselves is under control of hormones, and the key players are these genes with a terrible name, peroxisome proliferator activated receptors. And that name is an artifact of history. These are fatty acid receptors. And it turns out that this receptor that I discovered when I was a postdoc by complete accident, PPAR gamma, is the master regulator of obesity, of adipogenesis. So if you express this gene in a stem cell, that stem cell is now a pre-adipocyte. If you activate it, the cell becomes an adipocyte. And if you activate it in an adipocyte, that stores more fat. So it's a very, very important player. We've heard the name, the title, endocrine disrupting chemicals. So according to endocrinologists, endocrine disruptors are chemicals or mixtures of chemicals that interfere with how hormones work. And that can be the wrong signal, the absence of the signal, or the right signal at the wrong place at the wrong time. And you've heard that because hormones work at low levels, it's certainly possible that so do endocrine disruptors. How are we exposed? By now you know that there are persistent pollutants in our food and water. There are pesticides, herbicides, fungicides, food packaging. We willingly expose ourselves all the time to personal care products that are full of endocrine disruptors, cleaning materials. They're basically everywhere. Here's just a list of a few of the chemicals that we know about. They fall into a whole bunch of categories that you've seen before: pesticides, herbicides, fungicides, flame retardants especially, sunscreens, plasticizers. There's probably more than 1,000 endocrine disruptors, and we really have little idea about how many there are because no one is testing for them. The EPA is supposed to be testing for them, and they're doing an absolutely abysmal job. And that's, I'm being kind. So what I and my colleagues have been working on for probably 15 years now is whether endocrine disruptor mediated disturbances in how our bodies signal has something to do with our kids starting to look like this. And this is a cartoon that doesn't reflect reality, but unfortunately in this country we have lots and lots of fat kids. And although the obesity epidemic is worldwide, if you travel to Europe, if you travel to Asia, you will not see lots of obese kids. You'll see obese adults, but obese kids is much less frequent. And the problem is that obese kids very often grow up to become obese adults. And we know that once you become obese, it is very, very difficult to reverse that. And in fact, statistics show that 83% of people who fight hard and lose large amounts of weight, think America's Biggest Loser, gain that weight back within a few years. So something is going on here that's more than just eating too much and exercising too little. So based on the work that I'll talk about, we came up with what we call the obesogen hypothesis. And according to me, obesogens are chemicals that inappropriately stimulate the development of fat and the storage of fat, either directly by fiddling with the fat cells themselves or by altering metabolism, appetite, and satiety, how those work. So is there any evidence for this, or is this just my personal way to scam NIH out of some money? Well, Pete showed you Rita Newbold's fat mice. And Rita exposed these mice for 5 days after birth to a very tiny amount of an estrogenic chemical called diethylstilbestrol. And they got fat later in life, despite eating a completely normal diet. We know that there are drugs that make people fat. One particular class are called thiazolidinediones. The drug is called Avandia. It's a diabetes drug that makes people more sensitive to insulin, but it also makes them fat. We know, Shanna told you about urinary phthalate levels, and they also happen to correlate with waist diameter and insulin resistance in humans. And there's probably 24 or so chemicals now that have been linked with obesity in epi studies. That doesn't prove that they caused obesity, but if you look in obese people, you find the presence of these chemicals at higher levels than otherwise. So that says we ought to test those in controlled animal studies and see whether there's a real connection. And we know there are quite a few chemicals that can convert cells in culture into fat cells. The phthalates do it, bisphenols do it, perfluorinated chemicals do it, and organotins, which is my accidental favorite class of chemicals to study. So I would say that the existence of obesogens, even before I did the work that I'm going to tell you about, was already plausible, even though no one believed it. So how did I become interested in this? This is our favorite chemical, tributyltin. And this is one of the first examples of a chemical that's an endocrine disruptor for which there wasn't any controversy at all. This is present at parts per billion in seawater from leaching off ships, and at parts per billion it causes what's called imposex. These mollusks grow an absolutely gigantic penis and they can't mate anymore. I became interested in this chemical because we were already working on it in collaboration with our Japanese colleagues, screening for its ability to activate a different receptor, and I heard that it sex reversed fishes. Now by training, I'm a vertebrate developmental biologist, so you sex reverse vertebrate and you got my attention. So I called back to the lab and I said, guys, will you please test which of the 48 hormone receptors this chemical activates? And to our great surprise, we found out that it activated our friend PPAR gamma and another receptor called RXR, and those two work together to be the master regulator of adipogenesis. So there's only one way to go with these data. Once you have them, we had to study chemicals in fat, or else forget about the whole thing. So we did that, and we could show that it bound very avidly to those receptors, that it could induce cells in culture to become fat cells, and that it could make mice get fat when we exposed them in vivo. And we also showed that this prenatal exposure caused an epigenetic change that programmed the stem cells to become fat cells. I don't have time to show you all those data, but I'll show you a few little tidbits. So the next question we asked was whether these effects were heritable. And of course, the reason we asked that question, Pete alluded to, was because of Mike Skinner had showed that in a certain set of circumstances, he could cause lasting effects of a pesticide exposure on rats. So we treated pregnant mice throughout pregnancy with very low levels of tributyltin. So we're talking about parts per billion. And this is down around the level at which humans are exposed. And the babies were exposed inside of mom. That's the F1 generation. And we took this all the way out to the F3 generation. And in the field, we call these two generations, F1 and F2, a multi-generational effect because the fetus is exposed as F1 and the F2 generation is exposed as a germ cell inside the F1. So the F1 and the F2 generation are exposed. The F3 generation and F4 and F5 and beyond have never seen the chemical. They're only seeing the echoing of the effects, the direct effects. And what we could show was that the animals didn't weigh anymore, but they had more white adipose tissue, the kind of adipose tissue that we don't like to see, more fat cells, bigger fat cells, the brown fat didn't work correctly anymore, and they had fatty livers. So we got a big grant to study, what's the mechanism of this? So it's fine, that's a phenomenon, right? You made the mice fat, okay, how did we do that? And because the director of NIHS, Linda Birnbaum, is a very demanding person, she said, and I want you to do F4. And I said, well, then you need to give us more money, Linda. So we made a little bit smaller experiment. We just test two doses of TBT, and we went all the way out to F4. So these experiments take a year just to collect the data. So my poor postdoc, Raquel Chamorro Garcia, has now done 3 year-long transgenerational experiments. And we looked in these animals at the genes that were expressed. We looked at the methylation of DNA and lots of other factors. So the two things I'm going to show you have to do with the effects of diet on F4 animals. So in human terms, the F4 animals are the great, great grandchildren of the exposed mom. And so keep that in your mind. So what we did is we left these animals on a normal low-fat diet, and when they were 19 weeks old, we switched them to a slightly higher fat diet, right? So 21% fat is not a very high fat diet. And we kept them on that diet for 6 weeks, and then we switched them back. And we asked, what did that do to these animals? Hello. So the first thing we could show is that these animals didn't lose fat. So when you take a normal mouse and you fast it for 4 hours or you fast it for overnight, they lose a fair amount of weight. And what we could show is that the animals that were exposed to TBT lost a little bit less weight at 4 hours, but at 16 hours, they really resisted losing fat. They didn't let go of that fat that they had gained. So they were unable to mobilize that fat like normal animals were. The second thing, like in the previous experiments I showed you, the weight didn't change. So here's the TBT animals are in the dotted line, and over the course of the high-fat diet, there was no difference in the weight of the control group or the TBT group. They both got fat. But, so that says body weight is not an acceptable surrogate for obesity, which you'll see a lot in the literature. The toxicologists will say the animals didn't gain weight, they're not fat. Well, we did MRI and we asked the question, what's the body composition look like? So this is lean mass and this is fat mass. So you can see that already at 19 weeks old, the TBT males were a little bit fatter. And within 1 week, when we gave them the higher fat diet, boom, they gained 5% more of their body weight in fat, and they got quite fat, and they kept that weight on when we switched them back to the normal diet. What we didn't see was that effect in females. This is a male-specific effect, and we've now reproduced that twice. So only the male animals respond to diet in this way. So in the few minutes I have left, I'll tell you something about what we've learned about how this happens. So I've shown you some biological data. They get more fat at 8 weeks old. They respond to the diet at 19, and they don't mobilize fat. So we did a whole ton of molecular analyses because that's what our grant was about. And we asked, what happened to methylation of DNA? So that's an epigenetic change that controls how genes are expressed. And we asked which genes were expressed or not expressed. So this is a very complicated slide. This is just showing changes in methylation. And you can see that there's regions where there's more methylation or less methylation throughout the whole genome. That was immediately a problem because it's not allowed to happen. Okay? Methylation gets erased every generation in the development of the germ cells. When the sperm and eggs are developing, methylation is erased. So how do we see changes in methylation in the F4 generation? So that's a big problem. An opportunity also. Normally, when you see changes in methylation, it happens close to genes, and that makes the gene be more or less expressed by the presence of the methylation. We didn't see that. Instead, what we saw when we looked up at the 30,000 foot view was we saw regions where the methylation all went in one direction, either up or down. And then we asked the question, does that have any association with whether genes are expressed or not? So you can look here, this is a zoom of a couple slides ago, and you can see there are regions where the methylation all goes in one direction. And we called those iso-DMBs. And when we looked at gene expression through that lens, all of a sudden we could see that there were quite a few genes that were involved in fat and the development of fat and the metabolism of fat that had their expression changed. And I can plot these on a whole cellular pathway, but the one that caught our attention immediately was leptin. Leptin is the satiety hormone. It's the regulator of energy metabolism in the body. And sure enough, leptin is within a hypo and undermethylated iso-DMB. So that means it should be expressed more. And in fact, it is expressed more. So leptin messenger RNA is increased. And leptin protein in the serum is increased. So these animals are fat and they're leptin resistant. And for any of the clinicians here, you know that fat plus elevated leptin means leptin resistance. So these animals are resistant to leptin as a result of their great-great-grandmother's exposure during pregnancy. What we think is happening, you may or may not know this, the DNA in your cells is like a bowl of spaghetti. There it's wound up, but it has a structure. So parts of that bowl of spaghetti like to be next to each other, and they're linked to each other, and you can see it here in colors. What we think is happening is in the TBT-exposed animals, we've scrambled up that structure, that three-dimensional structure, and that alters access to the enzymes that put methyl groups on and take methyl groups off, and that leads to changes in the expression of these genes. So I'll show you just a couple pieces of data that support that. This is an assay that measures how accessible the DNA is to being altered. So is it open or is it closed? And this is in sperm from F3 and F4 generation. So I'm showing you the males of the F4 generation. So the F3 sperm generated those males, and the F4 sperm would be the next generation that we didn't assay because we stopped it at 3. And what you can see is that in the F3 and F4 sperm, there are quite a few genes that are involved in energy metabolism whose structure is changed. And the structure in the sperm is less accessible, and that is associated with more accessible in the fat cells. I'm going to skip this because we're almost out of time. And I'll just summarize that this, in a new experiment, that exposing pregnant moms led to changes in the accessibility of DNA only in the males, and it's already happening in the very first generation. We can follow that change in the primordial germ cells, which will give rise to the sperm. So we think that these effects of TBT are carried by altered structure of the way the chromosomes are folded up inside the nucleus, and it's that's propagated from generation to generation. So what have I showed you? And briefly, I think there are such things as obesogens, that organotins are one. They're very potent activators of these receptors that are important for the development of fat. TBT makes all kinds of animals fat, as Tyrone showed you with atrazine the other day. These effects of maternal exposure last forever. They're transgenerational. We think at least part of this has to do with making the animals leptin resistant so that they do not respond to leptin. What are the implications for humans? Why do we care? The first is that diet and exercise by themselves do not explain the obesity epidemic. And that's important because still today in 2018, we hear that we eat too much and we exercise too little. And we do, but that's not the whole story. There are such things as obesogens that inappropriately stimulate the development of fat. And we know that because there are pharmaceutical obesogens. There are plenty of drugs that we take that make us fat. Thiazolidinediones do it. All kinds of antidepressants do it. They make people fat. So if drugs that we take have the side effect of making us fat, why wouldn't chemicals that target the same receptors or the same pathways have the same effect? Of course they're going to have the same effect. And I've shown you what some of these are. A key point is that prenatal obesogen exposure reprograms the exposed animals and their descendants to be fat. It's changing the fate of stem cells, it's altering the structure of DNA, that leads to heritable changes. I love this cartoon. It's exactly like my mice. His epigenome has interacted with his diet to make him into a blimp. It's exactly my mice. But seriously, it says that the existence of obesogen says even more that we have to shift the paradigm from doing lap band surgeries on obese people to preventing kids from becoming obese in the first place. And we, of course, know how to do that. We need to reduce exposure to obesogens. They need to eat the right food and the right amount. This is not that difficult. But we have the multinational food industry that's driving us to eat addictive food that makes us fat. Shanna alluded at this. I love this slide too. This some government regulator initially said FDA. And it says, we do test for the safety of pesticides in your food. It's kind of a long-term test. And it is. And we are the subjects. And you can see the results of this test. According to the World Health Organization, non-communicable diseases, that is things that don't come from viruses, bacteria, are the leading cause of death in the world. And they're on the rise. And chemicals have some role in that rise. Lastly, I'll acknowledge the people that have done this work. The leader in my lab for 7 years now doing this is Raquel Chamorro Garcia. And she's had help from others. Carlos Diaz Castillo is the one who made the conceptual leap that it's not methylation in genes, but it's methylation in regions and therefore structure. That's really changed our thinking about this. Toshi Shoda at Harvard Medical School has done all the genomic analysis that I didn't have time to go into great detail with. And NIEHS has paid for all this. I'll stop there. I went too long and answer a few questions.
Thank you very much, Bruce. You can never talk too long.
So Bruce, last night you heard me mention that I had been in a rock band as a teenager. I was also a softball pitcher. So tell me about this book.
So I wasn't going to be so bold as to say I wrote a book. But what I said is a little bit complicated. And I wrote a book for the general audience so that anyone who wants to understand can understand not only the work we've done, but all of the factors that are involved in obesity, from microbiome to disruption of circadian rhythms, the whole gamut, and how to avoid those.
The obesogen effect. March 20th.
I wasn't going to mention, but Pete forced me, so.
I'm fascinated by the sexual dimorphism of the resistance to leptin. Could you say a little more about that?
All that we know at this point is that the males are leptin resistant and not the females.
Why? And you have the greater obesity. Mm-hmm.
Right. So I can show, I don't want to bore this whole audience, but I can show you the data that we have showing that it's transmitted, it looks like, through the male germline. That the effect we see in PGCs from males, but not in females. That doesn't prove it, but that's consistent with the idea that it's just the males that are affected.
We have one question over here. This will be the last question.
Oh, okay. Thank you very much for this very important statistical and very informative interconnection. But when you said African Americans and Asians and so on, I want to bring to attention everybody how important urban environments are. And we have a colleague at Carnegie Mellon who's GIS systems. And she can take the map of Pittsburgh and she can look where there are sidewalks and where there were sidewalks, where there are no bicycle paths, and what happens from school to going home through unsafe neighborhoods. And the obesity is much higher among those children in those neighborhoods. So your statistic is extremely important, but we need to also relate it to urban systems. And in New York City, the obesity is much lower than in many of the ex-urban neighborhoods. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. Unfortunately, the underprivileged populations tend to live in areas that are more polluted. They're near highways. There are many, many factors, including less access to good food, less access to bicycling, and all the factors that you mentioned. I completely agree. And I think Leo will probably tell us more about that.
So let's thank Bruce one more time.
Thank you.